Your mercy has found me. Your kindness has captured my heart. Your patience has grounded me in love that will never fade away. Now I know. Now I see. Peace has surrounded me, and now all is well with my soul. Your words have astounded me, they still every wave and calm the storm. The face of your mercy The face of your mercy Your mercy has found Your kindness has captured my heart. Your healing confounded me and plunged me beneath a cleansing flood. Now I know. Now I see. Face of your mercy, the face of your mercy, the face of your mercy, the face of your mercy.
Oh, it's such an overwhelming fragrance of Jesus' liberating presence the first time we receive His mercy. Like walking into greenhouse air filled with the explosion of a thousand roses, there's just nothing that can compare. But each time, that encounter exceeds the one before. Faithfully, without fail, with each touch of His forgiving hand, the eye of our heart opens a little more, and His face begins to emerge from the murky mask of a world willfully separated from Him. The only requirement from us is to welcome those intimate moments with Him with trust exclusively in Him. Trusting that He's our Father, Creator, that He's our Savior, the lover of our souls. Not just that He's out there somewhere beyond this world thinking about us, but that He's everywhere, in everything, and we can see Him and interact with Him in unbroken intimacy. Simply look out toward him. Look, believing, you are looking into each other's eyes. Open your eyes and let your heart behold him right there with you, closer than even your own soul. Say his name out loud. Jesus. Yeshua. Yesu. Yisa. And listen with the ears of your heart. He wants to talk to you. He wants to walk with you through this day that he's created for you and him to enjoy together. We're responsible to make time for concentrating exclusively on him. Whether it's an hour reading his book and responding to what he's said to us, or a moment's recognition, a glimpse of him in a surprise or a challenge, acknowledging that he designed it to be his voice privately heard in our heart. Those loving nudges brighten our outlook and give us tangible entry into personal engagement with his work to rid us of our self-consciousness and to become conscious of him and the opportunity for him to touch someone with our hand or for him to speak to them through our lips. That engagement is the life he has bought our freedom to enjoy with him forever. Make a new habit. Start today. Look up, look for him, and engage in what he's doing right now. What else could be more right, more fruitful, or more satisfying? Welcome to Terry Clark and Friends. We're glad you tuned in today. I've got a very special guest today, Steve Grison. You may not have heard his name, but if you've seen the First Love DVD series, he's the guy that did the video production for that. I'm so pleased to have Steve as my guest today because he's just a unique guy that's been all over the world, all over input and output of the music industry as well as the film industry. And right now he's very deeply involved in film. He's done some incredible projects, over 200, I believe. And Steve, thank you for being a part of my craziness today and the Lord's whatever he's up to get us to talk out loud on this program. Thank you for coming.
You're welcome. It's always great to hang out, Terry. As you remember, we go back to the early days where we ended up being next door neighbors in an apartment complex. We were both young marrieds and just ended up living right next door to each other.
Yeah.
So that started a friendship that is, I count as a priceless journey in my life. And we live in Colorado, you live in California. So whenever you come, it's like old home week. Feels like nothing's changed. Here we go again.
Yeah, I know. We pick up right where we left off. We never lose our place, do we?
No, we don't. And, you know, the honor to me was we were young and really had committed to listening to God's call. And
yeah.
You guys have done the same.
Yeah.
And here we are. How many years later? I don't even want to count the years. And we're still going forward. And we have so much, as we look back, to be grateful for. God took us on a journey that was blown our minds.
Well, yeah, you said a mouthful there. Because, I mean, who would have thunk when they're in that little apartment complex in Northridge, California? It seemed like a little hotbed of some kind. I don't know what was going on. There was Terry Talbot was across the sidewalk from us, and you were down a couple of doors from us. And then we had, I think we surrounded this couple from New York in the middle of us that made great fresh cannolis. And we became close friends in that little block of apartments.
I remember we had amazing bands, like Christian bands, that were rehearsing in the clubhouse.
You could go
out of the clubhouse and hear some of the best playing you'd ever hear in the valley, right?
That's
all these
right.
great players.
That's right.
Who were like, oh, here's a place we can rehearse. It was great.
Well, Steve, I want to dig a little bit into the foundations. I know that we could go on for days with the history of where God started to talk to you and all of that environment that you were born into. Could you just open that up a little bit and give us the picture of where all that started and where you were and what your family was doing? And, of course, you inherited some of that sensitivity to the Lord's voice.
Well, yeah, in a way, I certainly did. I mean, my parents decided they wanted to be missionaries overseas. They had a very good friend who had moved to Calcutta, India, probably at the time the darkest place on earth in 1954. Mm-hmm. This was a childhood friend of theirs, and so they figured they would get ready and go join him. And in the last minute, the mission they worked with called and said, look, we have this really big need over in Hong Kong. Would you divert to Hong Kong? And so our family ended up in Hong Kong. My parents were there 30 years, and I grew up there as a kid. I got there at 6 years old. I went all the way through my high school years in Hong Kong and just ended up loving that whole experience. But really didn't follow the Lord till the time I almost left Hong Kong. Interestingly enough, I'd been around God's goodness, been around good people that love the Lord.
Yeah.
And always felt like God was speaking in my life. I wasn't deaf to his voice, but right. I was young and arrogant and wasn't that interested in following him. Yeah. Vietnam was underway, so all these guys would R&R in my town, and I was a pool shark. I would take all this money from these GIs, they'd be chasing me down alleys trying to get their money back.
Right
from the beginning, you know. And my dad, speaking of the business entrepreneurialism, it is always in there. You see it surface. But, you know, my dad only gave me $1 a week in allowance. That was $6 in Hong Kong money. So I had to scramble to make some cash. So I started breeding exotic animals. I built 350-gallon tanks in my bedroom and started breeding exotic fish.
Good grief.
I started farming pigs and chickens.
Chickens.
I didn't know anything about this. I just thought, let's do it, you know? And I started a music dubbing operation. I would get albums from the States before they released in Hong Kong, start cranking them out, illegal dubs.
He started that whole business over
and,
there.
Right. And so
they followed it ever since.
I was just doing fine. But later, we really had an outpouring of the Holy Spirit in Hong Kong. And we had a lady by the name of Jean Willens, who had been with Dennis Bennett in Van Nuys, California. Dennis Bennett's church was one of the first churches when the charismatic movement sort of spilled out of the Pentecostal movement and started moving into mainstream.
Uh-huh.
That church was one of the places, and she was the lady back in those days that actually named the charismatic movement. She was going to put the name
really?
On it. Really? Oh, my. Ended up moving as business people to Hong Kong and held a little Bible study, and a lot like what happened all over the West Coast. You'd cook, and you'd sing, and you'd read the word and you'd fellowship and just have a great time. But God would come. That was where the Lord really met me and my sisters, interestingly enough, my brother. A transformative experience for us. And I ended up moving back to the States and then went to a school my senior year. Part of my senior year was in Bellevue, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Started a little Bible study at that time. I was sort of on fire for the Lord, and we had 500 kids coming to that Bible study. In the yearbook, when we graduated, they divided the school up into three major categories. The freaks that were the druggies, right? The jocks.
And the Jesus freaks.
So then I heard Brother Andrew and Lauren Cunningham come through my town, and they were talking about, this was back in the dinosauric age, but they were talking about the Munich Olympic Games in 1972.
Oh, yeah.
And the outreach that was possible to reach the world. And so I ended up going to that. Got exposed to Youth with a Mission and thought, I like these guys.
Yeah.
Came back home. I was working for the Nordstrom's, and they only had two stores at that point. I was working in one of their stores, and I had gone to school with the girls.
Yeah.
And ended up saving money and going into YWAM and doing a year course in Switzerland. And it was during that time that I really just laid my life down and I said, you know, God, I want to give you the future. I don't know what it's supposed to look like. My dad thought I should be a pastor, and I knew that wasn't what I was supposed to do, because that was the way he defined following the Lord in his mind.
Sure.
But I knew I had something different, but I didn't know what it quite would be. Mm-hmm. I was musical. I had a small band and all this stuff. But I just said, you know, God, the path now is yours, and I want to listen and not just make assumptions and just go to college or do whatever without consulting you and having a sense of your guidance. So honestly, I tell people all the time, that right there was probably the most important moment in my life because that determined the journey.
Set your bearing.
And I look back now with the advantage of hindsight, I'm kind of blown away at that journey.
Right.
But the thing about faith is you never get to see the path in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
You only get to see it when you've walked it behind you.
Important to know.
Important. And so just trust, because you will be mind blown if you'll give it up. And that's what I did that day. And I try to give it up still all the time.
Oh, yeah. So that's what's on the table, isn't it?
That's what's on the table.
Because this life is just the qualifying stage for the main event. And that's what qualifies us, that we trust.
We trust. as you walk a while, you learn that God pays a little more attention when you're trusting in hard times, when you're trusting when you're sick or you got a disease or it ain't working out. And you still say, like Job, I trust you. Mm-hmm. I think that's just sweet to him, and he particularly pays attention. I know there are a lot of people that go through a lot of stuff, and we've all been through stuff, and we have very close loved ones, and people listening do too. But what's the option then to trust? You know?
Be berserk all the time.
Go fearful. Go crazy. Go mad. Go angry.
Be a black hole everywhere you go.
No, that's it.
Depression and all that.
Yeah. Yep. So God brings you hope and walks through the journey with you, gives you purpose, gives you gifts. Mm-hmm. I'm convinced that, you know, we get to be in this sort of society, appreciates you in music. And I've always said, Terry, you and I got to cut a deal where I get to transplant your vocal cords into mine when you die so I can do the Blue Eyed Soul thing because I love it so much. But, you know, I've been given some gifts and people like film or whatever. But I meet people all the time with all kinds of gifts. And I have them working for me as well, from administration, what will you consider sort of simple, but to me, so important gifts, and God has given people, whether they're teachers or plumbers or whatever they've been given, just understand and accept and be excited about the fact you've been given gifts from God, and go wholeheartedly
just
into your
life.
Just do it.
That sort of hints the answer to the question that's in my mind about, okay, there's a certain nature about you, a certain atmosphere or attitude, I guess, disposition that is unique, because there's not many people that just think so quickly of engaging people and drawing out their gift, as you've said. And I've talked with several people who had this history of growing up in a missionary family. And there's something connected and parallel to that about the training that you go through. Even if you're, like you said, not really paying that much attention, it's still the DNA that's being programmed into your life. So can you say anything to that? It's important to me because when I'm with you and Nellie, and we're out in the beauty of God's awesome majesty in the Rockies and all that kind of stuff, there's just a suction on you coming in the room that says, I want to know what conclusions you're making about what's happening in your life. That's a special gift, I think. And that's Jesus, really, because Jesus in you is always, you know, pulling you out into the open so that you can work together with him to make sense of life.
I guess I'm as appreciative as anybody else, because I look back and I go, you know, I'm not really all that fancy. My folks couldn't afford college. They dropped me off and said, we'll be back in 5 years and we can't really help you with college. So I didn't go to college. And I didn't have many advantages along the way. But at the same time, you know, I never had a small view of what my life could become. And I don't know exactly what that was. I looked at an interesting study. They listed these Fortune 500 company presidents. Three quarters of them were missionary kids. And
is
I began
right?
to look at, and I grew up with a bunch of these missionary kids. And so what they typically do is either over-rebel, almost die from drug overdoses and going crazy, or they finally swing around and they kind of go all in.
Turn everything
in
into gold.
The Lord, you know. And I, you know, in a way, I think so much of that, you know, in sort of this esoteric sense, is God's faithfulness to those families, because those people have, you know, taken their kids. In the old days, literally, there wasn't education for your kids and there was no homeschooling.
No.
So in a lot of cases, I grew up with kids that were shipped off to boarding schools.
Sure.
Things that would be considered almost cruel and unusual punishment now.
Yeah.
But I think that whole international experience gives you a bigger view of the world. And so you don't look at life with the same boundaries, maybe, that somebody that grew up in a neighborhood or a small town or a regular town or whatever. I think that's one of the things that God tries to, I think we got a quick advance course because of our life. But I think it's one of the things God's trying to do with every believer, is to lift the veil off the boundaries, how we see our world.
Oh, yeah.
And how we see that God can use us. Uh-huh. Because the story, as you know, Nellie, my wife, was part of this group called the Second Chapter of Acts, and they were thrown into a position by complete accident where their mother and dad died 2 years apart, and then they were left orphaned and discovered in that healing process that they could sing. So they sang, and nobody knew they could
really
sing. Their parents never even heard them sing.
Yeah.
And here, so God takes this sort of redemptive process and begins to use these young kids And so again, the message is, you know, God wants to use us, maybe not all like that, but it starts with us getting a bigger view of God and that's opening right. our eyes and letting him.
And it takes a threshold that's kind of looks like it's forced on us.
Sometimes
to break
it does
out.
To break out, you know, and to say, God has given me a call. Mm-hmm. And whatever that is going to be incredible.
Yeah, and whatever it is.
It's going to be incredible.
It just doesn't matter what it is.
And so don't like put small boundaries around your life mm-hmm. because God has got big ideas for your life. Not big mm-hmm. in the sense that you're going to be famous necessarily, but big in terms of impact.
Yeah.
And because there's a big world out there and he's decided the way he's going to reach it is he's going to partnership with us, his people.
That's right.
And he's not going to send the angels down to get the job done. He's going to work through his yeah. people. And so here we all are and it's good to be a part. Yeah. I'm grateful every day we still get to do some good stuff, and it's been fun.
It creates an atmosphere of curiosity and expedition, this kind of wanderlust of the mind and experience, because once you've started that, then it just gets better and better, because every corner you turn, every person you meet, you find something that this person, because of the threshold, the breakout that they've been forced to do, they become this creature that you can't put in a box, but it's so unique and supportive and supplementary to your own place that the Lord has rooted you in and used you in. And that's what I feel when I'm with you guys. And it's become my view of the body of Christ, because mm-hmm. we're not so much thinking of this central head that's synchronizing all of us all over the planet. Mm-hmm. We feel isolated, we feel alone, but if our focus is on the Lord, then he's getting what he wants, mm-hmm. and then he's using us the way he designed us. And growing that and forming us. And he's doing art, basically. Mm. He's sculpting us in the way that he designed us to
be. See, and
begin
I love
with.
That. And so many people I've been in my life fed my soul because I just, yeah. you know, and I look at you as a good friend. I can't imagine a world with no Terry Clark and that expression of worship that is poured into the hearts of people and let the Spirit then transform them
yeah.
because that voice was available. Mm. And so whether it's you and you have these friends and I have these friends, and they feed our soul when we're around them because they've allowed God to begin to use them. And we all need that wonderful challenge back.
Yes.
To be that's what the body of Christ is, to encourage
right.
each other.
That's
you know?
Right.
And I mean, stuff happens, and I haven't even told you know, half the stuff that happens, but you know, I'll just tell you one quick thing that
yeah.
I think you'll love. Years ago, we did a film called The Mystery of the Ark of the Covenant. And we looked at this mm-hmm. question of where the Ark of the Covenant goes, central to the life of Israel.
Fascinating film.
So part of the story ended up in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
And after the film was released, because there's 60 million people in Ethiopia that believe they have the Ark of the Covenant. So they're very proud of this. And scholars never believed it. So now everywhere I go in the world, if you go to any airport in America, it's filled with Ethiopians. Well, they all know who I am, right? Because of this film. I'm like this little cult hero with these Ethiopians, right? And when we filmed the show, they had just gone through this 14-year civil war in Ethiopia where the little airports were shot full of 50 cal.
Yeah, yeah.
These tin shack airports, you know, with big holes
yeah,
in them.
Right.
It was crazy. They were just post-war, so security was tight. It was serious pat-downs mm-hmm. and going through luggage
yeah.
and everything. Well, about 8 months ago, here in Colorado, I get a call from a guy up in Denver. And he says, Steve, I got a guy I want you to meet. And I knew him well enough to go, okay, well, that means just go. So, you know, I said, where, when? He goes, well, let's meet for lunch. We met for lunch. And my friend is about 6'10", this really big, tall guy, and he's with this short black guy, you know.
Yeah.
And so we sit down, and we kind of do, you know, nice to meet you, I'm so-and-so, the niceties. And then he goes, tell him your story to this black brother that he brought.
Mm-hmm.
And come to discover, first of all, the guy knew the film. He was an Ethiopian.
Mm-hmm.
But he was the resistance leader. At 17 years old. He and a buddy decided they didn't like the Soviet-backed government in Ethiopia.
Uh-huh.
And they started raiding these little outposts, shooting these guys up, taking all their munitions. And this led him over from the time, from 17 years old to 30 years old, he built a 100,000-man army in the jungles.
Oh, my goodness.
And ended up taking on the 1.2 million-man army of Ethiopia, and they won.
Good
so this
grief.
He became the prime. This guy was the former prime minister. Became the prime minister as Betty became the president.
Lordy.
But during this time, he had this encounter with Christ. It was just absolutely unbelievable. He tells me this story, and I'm going, "This just blows my mind." And he loved that he knew our film. He'd seen the film. We had gone out to this island, this this holy island of the Ethiopians. And he said, as president, I couldn't even get on that island. And, you know, we'd been out there, and it was just amazing. So, and then so years later, after we produced this film, I meet this guy who's the prime minister, probably going to be the prime minister again.
Yeah.
By all accounts, the existing prime minister is ready to step down. And this guy will probably go back home. And
wow.
But he lived up the road here in Denver, and we met.
He's sitting across the table.
And I'm looking at him, and I'm going, my goodness, you know, how in the world do you feed 100,000 guys in the jungle, feed a 100,000-man army? And just the logistics of that, and of course, the help from the farmers. And the story was just incredible, you know. And he had no knowledge of Christ. His buddy turned against him because power creates paranoid people. Ended up, his buddy threw him in jail. Spent 2 years trying to kill him. Put him in helicopters with loose rotors. Buses with bad brakes. And he never died for 2 years. He didn't know that he was trying to do this.
Ethiopian Apostle John.
Oh, my gosh. But he ended up in jail. And he literally, Jesus lit up his cell 3 a.m. and walks out of this bright light in the corner of the room and tells him who he is.
Grief.
He has no knowledge of Christ. He's never read a scripture. He wasn't an Islamist either. He was just a young guy with no knowledge.
Right.
And all Jesus said to him was, I've got your life in my hands, but you have to follow me. That was the message right there. And that's the message really to all of us.
Absolutely.
God's got our life in his hands.
Yes.
But what we have to do, we have to follow him.
Yeah.
Great message, right?
Absolutely. So, it is the message.
It's the message.
If you can boil it down to that, Jesus says one thing to us. Come here. Come here.
Yeah.
Let's go. And everything hinges on that. The problem is that we've been taught by many organizational cause-oriented kind of things. We've been taught that go into all the world means to get out there and just do stuff, you know, just do stuff. But go to the Hebrew didn't mean that. And this was a Hebrew Jesus speaking to Hebrew disciples. When he said go, they understood what's disclosed in Hebrews,
right,
which is the sin offering taken outside the city, and he's going, go out of yourself.
There you go.
Young men, go out of yourself.
So that's that whole boundary thing again.
Absolutely. Because your little city that you've built for yourself, your little bubble world, is in shambles. Admit it and come on out. Where the sin offering has been disposed of on Calvary, outside the gates, and let's get busy making disciples together. And then, of course, in Matthew in 28, he just opens that up. All five things. Go out of yourself. Then we can make disciples. We can reproduce this following.
That go is a scary moment. That's a critical step. That's the thing I talked about earlier.
Threshold.
16 and 17 years old when I made that commitment. There's everything pulling at you going, I just want to stay in the comfort zone of where I've been living.
Exactly.
But I tell you, there's so much freedom.
But it's God's grace, isn't it? He made us flesh so that we could go through these thresholds of choosing him. And that's why he made us like we are. And that's why he designed the world to be so antagonistic to that. And our bodies to say, I don't want to. So just leave me alone. But then whether it's you in that transformative moment of turning your life, your future over to the Lord, or it's the Ethiopian guy who Jesus just walks in the room. It's this grace that he comes and takes us out. He helps us make that decision. And, you know, he asks us to make the decision, but doesn't he do all the heavy lifting?
Heavy lifting, exactly. Exactly. He's got it all teed up. We just make it.
Because he's the illustration of that. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross.
Right.
And actually, the endurance, the deep endurance, was in Gethsemane. I just read that this morning in Oswald Chambers, because that's where the devil came back.
That's right.
Satan came back and said, you don't have to go through this. But he was so pressured by being flesh, it was possible that he could go through all of that and end up just an isolated man.
Yeah, you could.
Rather than redeeming the whole, world.
Yeah.
And that can be meditated on for a while. But the fact is that this all kind of continues to be an expedition into uncharted territory for all of us who have gone through those thresholds.
That's exactly right. And that's, you know, we call our company Exploration Films.
Yes.
For that very reason.
So perfect.
It's this whole expedition, which is sort of a modern Pilgrim's Progress sort of idea.
Exactly.
But Exploration Films describes that exploring and following with God.
Now, Exploration Films, you were in the music business and...
62 songs, original scores. How's
wow,
that?
Incredible. That's some investment.
Bear Man finale. It's a very simple, beautiful little track, isn't it?
Flugel.
I love this. I love that this music for this film, because the guy's life was so simple. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's all alone in a way.
Yeah.
So that flugelhorn kind of, it's like a trumpet, but it's more lonely.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's got
and
soul.
And all the instruments, except for this piece where he lets the orchestra swell a little bit. Very simple instruments like flutes and guitars and earthy instruments. Yeah.
Commission that kind of stuff, do you let them see the cut version of
whoever you're working with, you people work a little differently, but you work Charlie, what he likes to do, like he worked on Bear Man, what he likes to do is we do the cut, and it may not be the final but pretty close to the final. Mm-hmm. And we lay in library music, so just the way we would do it if we weren't using original music. And
sure.
Then he gets a feel for the emotions that we're trying to create.
Uh-huh.
And then he begins to write. So it doesn't really copy
that. So he kind of has a baseline, and then
you let him. Yeah, so he gets a feeling for, you know, because we're driving the emotional attitude of the piece by the music choices and by the cut.
Yeah.
And so he's wanting to make sure that what he writes is doing that as well. Yeah. Yeah. So, and then you go in and then you kind of like, you know, hey, I like this. I mean, it's hard because you're talking about something very esoteric. So he's trying to get in my head and I'm trying to say in English what is not really English words and describe music, you know. So
yeah, you're both using triggers.
And
to
if you get along, connect, you know how to
bring
connect
you out
with somebody, then it's easier.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people, we just can't connect with at all.
Right. Yeah. It's like they've never been to that territory inside themselves or something.
I can't really get there with you. So no.
It's interesting to me because when I do my workshops, and this is why master designer the song is so deeply resonant in me, because in my workshops, you know, what the Lord has shown me is that creation, that what he's designed is a symphony.
So
you know,
audible.
It's not audible to us. Mm-hmm. It's for his pleasure only. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we separated ourselves from enjoying that same thing.
Right.
But, you know, we have such a small little audio frequency range that we take 20 to 20, you know, is not really very wide.
No.
But I tell them that when you tune up, and God is listening for us to tune up, because until then we're singing our own note, and it's complete. We don't realize it, but it's completely dissonant to what creation is doing.
Right.
Although in our soul, in our spirit, it creates this angst, this stress that's going to our bones. And we talked about the inflammation in our bodies are caused by chemicals. The chemicals are emotions.
Exactly.
They are the
force. Well, and just like
the force.
We said that light and everything is a frequency. God spoke the world with light. So we enjoy the frequencies of music, which are 20 to 20, which is within our hearing. But when the lid is going to be taken off our ears and we're going to be able to hear mm-hmm. the song of nature that we see, but we can't hear the song.
Yeah.
It's all going to be wind-blowing.
Well, if we heard it now, it'd blow the ears right out of our head, right?
Couldn't handle it, right?
Well, okay, let's talk about that for a minute, because I believe that both of us have had the same experience, because you were in music for so long, and you know, young people are driven by I want to be a star kind of thing, and I've got this desire to play the guitar and sing and write these songs. Well, the fact is that most of the music in that disconnected self-projecting kind of thing, the music doesn't say what you're trying to say lyrically. The music says it first, because God said, let there be light. And as we tune up, then the music that's already playing becomes the song. If we understand what worship is, it is music. It's the personal song that's being sung as we tune up with the rest. And it adds this unique little melody line harmonic. That's so beautiful. Now, we're living in a world that doesn't care about those things. It cares about marketable, what people will be excited to see. And of course, you've got a whole lot of things going on in there. Now, this is convoluted a little bit, because coming from that mentality, understanding that, and the stuff that you've disclosed in your films just makes it monumental in my mind that God has you doing what he has you doing. And I'm wondering if Exploration Films is really coining the word, and of course Hebrews think of words as packages, and what we do is we find that word, that the more you open it up, the more you understand the significance of what's going on. Now, Exploration Film is a whole commission to do what? And add to that a layer of, I know you're part of what God has given you is this sense about what really gets the job done, which is to get people to break out of the darkness into the light and eventually come home. But somehow you've got to get them infected with it.
So the vehicle for me, I loved music growing up. I was a young musician. It was okay, but it wasn't great. I met my wife. She was amazing.
Yeah.
But I loved music, and it was always a part of my soul. My parents were musicians. So I was very connected to music. It spoke deep for me. So then later, as a young guy, I got into photography, so I became really connected to great imagery and composition. For years of shooting, I began to see the world through that lens of how I'd been trained to look at things. And then I was a natural writer. So it's interesting, my brothers and sisters are all that way as well.
Huh.
Where while I didn't have any real formal training, I could write words on pages and they came out decent. And it wasn't always super easy for me.
Right.
But like if you went to Exploration Films blog, you'll see some of that writing.
Yeah.
And here was a way with film that I could combine all those pieces. And I found that combined they were more powerful than any of them were individually.
Yeah.
So now, you know, we live in a world where a story speaks probably deeper than a sermon.
Yes.
Because people are listening for a story in life, a real story that they can be
rather
a part
than
of
critiquing
and buy into.
The pastor.
That's right. And then at that point, you know, it's just a matter of the Lord has led us to these incredible stories that we've done. I mean, people
yes.
look at the lineup of stuff we've done and they go, how in the world did you ever figure this out? And I'm going, really, guys, I'm not that smart. I'm not that organized. All of this stuff came to me because all of it pretty much was a happy accident. It all walked
and you were
in
looking.
The door. And I wasn't exactly.
Your eyes were open.
And then the other part with this new film that we've just finished called The Master Designer, the song, it tied together in kind of a fun way my lifelong connection with animals. You know, when I was raised in Asia, as I said before, in addition to raising pigs and chickens and breeding exotic fish, I had 16 German shepherds. I had 2 pet monkeys. I had monkeys Good riding
grief.
On my handlebars of my bicycles during the day.
All and, that in your apartment, huh?
And all that in my high-rise.
One of those high-rise
Yeah,
Hong
exactly.
Kong.
It's weird. weird because as I lived my life and I looked back, my life had always intersected animals in sort of a unique way. I never really considered myself like the animal guy.
No.
But I always liked animals. Just, you know, I was just connected with them. It was just part of life for me.
Yeah.
And then when I think about it, it's a part of life that I can't imagine not having now. So the animal-based shows that we were able to do, we were able to walk into nature. I mean, sort of was a natural fit for the way I was, you know.
Yeah.
And then being able to combine great music and visuals and storytelling and to get insight into the message of nature, because scripture talks about nature is an incredible song, a sermon for all of us if we'll listen. You know, it's a metaphor in a lot of ways because we're all busy and people, as you said earlier, they miss so much because we're the pursuit of getting our needs met and materialism and paying our car payments and getting to work. And
exactly.
And the thing about living in Colorado is you get a chance to walk up to the high country and be on a trail and it's dead quiet and it's beautiful and you get a chance to reflect. Now, I grew up in a city of 7 million people in Hong Kong and that wasn't part of life then, you know what I mean?
Right.
Because it was a noisy city. You know, you live in LA, it's a noisy city. New York, it's a noisy city. And trying to get that balance in your life between hearing God in nature, because there's so much story to be told there. And so what we've tried to do is bring some of that into film and allow people to begin to connect with that. And it's a beautiful thing because people love nature and they love animals, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a way, it's an entry in to even the most hardened heart, because you fall in love with these beautiful creatures and then you begin to see God's purpose in all of it, and it's really wonderful.
And with just a little bit of guidance, and it takes a little bit because of the nature of the corrupting of people's minds and the programming and to keep God out of everything, with just a little bit of guidance, you don't have to tell them the point. They get the point because the Holy Spirit is really a pretty powerful communicator.
Well, and that's always been my thing. Now, the problem is they sometimes don't get a chance to get the point because you have a culture and a school system that immediately wants to steal God's glory and say this all evolved without a God.
Yeah.
And if nobody would have said anything, if we would have all been out on an island and grown up from babies, we would acknowledge that there was a God behind this.
Oh yeah.
But here's somebody trying to steal that thought out of your mind from being in junior high school, and elementary school even. So some of those ideas we challenge and we try to shock people back into the idea that, no, here's some really incredible stuff that proves the opposite of that.
What do you think? I've always been puzzled by that adamant aggression. I know it's from the darkness, it's from the evil one, but that doesn't tell me what the hook really is. There's got to be a flesh hook in that somewhere that gets people to buy into that enough to just lambast everybody that would have anything to do with.
Well, I've just come to understand that the big idea is, first of all, science is our friend. Now, some of the conclusions that people make around science are not the things we agree with.
Yeah, exactly.
But what science has ultimately done is the more we've looked, you know, you want to go out to the heavens, the farthest you can go, or you want to go into your skin and into the cell, into the tiniest thing that way, it just explodes with information on God's masterful design of this world.
I know. It doesn't matter which direction you go, you run into
him. And I, you know, I can't imagine in 100 years how mind-blown we'll be, because I'm mind-blown now, and that's what we do in these films. We blow people's mind with the evidence. But you have a whole side of this, there's this whole culture out there that is saying that God was not involved. Now, for somebody that's not wanting God in their life, not wanting an accountable relationship to him, it's we can throw off this idea that God has designed us, that we're accountable to him, that he's given us the life he's going to ask us to give an account for, and we can live the way we want. And so it's this march of rebellion expressed through these scientific ideas against the God who created it all. And even the grand thinkers, when I've talked to them, they said, we will not even ever consider the idea of God because we're in the business of studying naturalism. So unless we can see and prove it, that's the only evidence we'll consider. So now you've shut the door.
So on any kind of
so
faith.
To the unseen hand
that
made it all.
That's a good disclosure of what's going on, and it makes it clear to me that it's just the continuation of this separation that happened in the garden.
Exactly.
Because they, Adam and Eve both determine, and Adam really makes the decision to say to God, thank you very much, we'll take it from here. And we have that so ingrained. And don't all the geneticists, now that they've mapped the genome, they can see it. And I've heard several reports of, as they're going through, they actually go, oh my goodness, something happened here.
That was Francis
and it just
Collins. You know,
he broke
was,
it, broke
he,
the DNA.
He headed the genome project. And he, by his own testimony, he was a complete atheist when he he started.
Yeah.
But the evidence was undeniable. There's just no way.
Say his name again.
Francis Collins.
Collins,
and he's featured in this film. He just said the evidence was undeniable that there was a God behind this. It could not have randomly happened. It was impossible statistically for that to happen.
In this film that we're talking about?
Yeah. So we do in Master Designer, we do a little segment called Science versus God. Has science now buried the idea of God? And we talk about how that the grand idea behind science was a big assumption. And without this assumption, it gave place to the birth of science. And the assumption was that the world was orderly. So as scientists, our job was to understand the order that's already been imposed on the world. Now, that was first put forward by the Hebrews 3,000 years ago, who wrote that God created the world and created the order that we see in the world. That was the first place it was put forward. So this is why, out of this Judeo-Christian Western idea, which became influenced by Christianity, science came
out. Science was born.
It wasn't born out of India.
No.
It wasn't born out of Asia, right?
Wordy.
It was because they didn't have that premise.
No.
And so then we look back at all the great thinkers, and could you be a man of science and believe in a creator God? Because today, people would teach you to believe that's impossible. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Science is, you know, over here, and people of faith are over here. But no, from Galileo to Louis Pasteur to all the founders of science, all believed in a creator God.
Yeah.
And as Kepler so aptly put, he said, science's job is to understand the order that God has imposed upon the world, and by that, think God's thoughts after him. Great line. Fantastic.
So a person has that premise that comes from there. It's easy for them to sit under an apple tree, and the apple comes down, and they go, ding. Now, I stood in the pulpit in the room where that guy was one of the professors in Cambridge. And this guy that was just so passionate for God that saw us as a group. I had taken a dozen people from America and gone on this UK tour. And he said, let me take you on the tour of Cambridge and show you who established this whole thing. And he would actually come into a room and start telling the story about these great scientific minds that are there to worship God.
Absolutely.
And so
the great universities, God, Harvard, William and Mary College, and you go down the line.
He'd break into tears.
Yeah.
And the tears come partly from the awe of God, which is disclosed by every one of those discoveries, explorations into reality, the reality of God. And every one of them just blows the doors down, because we naturally build the walls around what we know, but it just blows it off every day.
You know, something you said got my attention. It's very interesting. So when you talked about Adam in the garden, who basically said, okay, God, we got it from here, right? And displays this massive lack of humility in the position he's in.
Yeah.
Completely, you know, this pride thing comes up. He completely loses all ability to have any humility about his situation, his creation, anything around him.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, on the opposite, you have God's amazing humility, because think about it. If I was God, what I would do is I'd go, boom, blow up 3,000 bolts of lightning, have archangels come on fire and stand around him and go, hello?
Yeah.
Right? That's what I would do, right?
Yeah.
But God's Mr. Low-key, and he's always low-key, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
It's, I call it the subtlety of God, right?
Yeah.
Because he never comes in like a lion into your heart. What he does is he calls, right? In a still small voice and waits for you to respond.
Yeah.
He doesn't badger you or bludgeon you with his truth.
Yeah.
He calls you gently with his with his call. And I think in a way, because we're all frail sheep.
That's right.
We are not ready for a loud voice, let me tell you. We are not. And that gentle voice is the thing that leads us on. So I look at God's humility in that picture as well to say, then I'll just be patient, because you'll learn.
Yes, you'll learn. And you see that in that final Pasach in the chambers with Jesus, the disciples are there, and it says that Jesus, knowing that all things were under his authority, rose from the table, took a towel, and washed their feet.
It's beautiful.
The fullness of the Godhead in flesh, right there, washing your feet. Incredible irony from our point of view of saying, I'll take it from here.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But he surrendered his position of being under the authority of God and being the head of his household. He surrendered that position.
But that goes back to that thing that we talked about earlier about
turns everything upside down.
16-year-old decision that I made. At some point, you surrender your life to God, and you have to keep it surrendered.
Yeah,
because that's where your authority for your future comes from, right?
Yeah.
So the idea that you're going to love God, follow Him, but do your life. A lot of people out there like that, and God's kind to them. Don't get me wrong; He doesn't abandon them.
No.
But you're not going to necessarily have the life that you could have had.
It's not going to be...
Because you're going to miss big pieces that he's
transcendent
got for you. That's it.
Thing every day. That, I mean, you can only experience that if you're walking through those thresholds every day that he says, come. I'm convinced that we wall ourselves in, okay?
Yeah.
And we come head on to a brick wall. And if we're looking for him, if we're humbled by it, and we renew our surrender, if we're in that state of mind, kind of held in limbo between the desperation and the hint of hope, Jesus just opens a door right in front of us in the brick wall. And he's on the other side going, come here, come on through.
Yeah.
And for the joy set before us, and to be able to go through those thresholds, not just once a day, it's a constant thing with him. He can show up anytime in any situation. In fact, he wants to show up in everything he's designed to challenge where you are. And that's every conversation.
Right.
Every little question that comes up. It's an amazing life. I can't believe it. And this is just the qualifying stage.
That's
he's
right.
going to continue to blow our minds right through eternity. What's next, Steve? I know you're always working on something.
I'm working on a project now with the Denver Symphony, one of the great symphonies in the U.S. The guy that has written some scores for me on some projects is a guy named Charles Denler. And Charlie was commissioned by that symphony to write a modern American symphony. It's not been very, very many of these written, by the way.
No.
And they said, we want you to write a modern symphony based on the Rockies. And Charlie, being a believer, calls me up and he goes, you know, Steve, he said, I really want you involved in this thing with me from the beginning. He said, I'm seeing these mountains being created, God moving upon this beauty. And I'm doing a documentary film on the making of a modern symphony. Then we've got this great performance.
Oh, really?
Shooting it all in 4K, ultra high def. And and then I'm weaving Charlie's story in. He was a young musical guy, worked for his dad in construction, sat up on a roof and be writing out music. Yeah. All the people in the school, his teachers telling him, you'll never do good in music, do something else, you know. Yeah. And he becomes a 3-time Emmy Award-winning film composer and beautifully expresses his love for God through his music, instrumental music. His journey is a beautiful story. He invented a piano, technology in a piano box. And that was called the Purple Piano. He put out this album called the Purple Piano. He said, I ran 1,000 of them and sold 10 of them, you know, and like a lot of musicians do. But one of the people that got a hold of this album was a guy at Nat Geo. This is before they started the National Geographic Channel.
Wow.
So he called him up one day and he goes, have you ever considered doing music for film? And he said, they gave me a film to work on. He said, I started writing this music for this film. And he said, I always believed as a believer, as someone that loved the Lord, that somehow the Holy Spirit would flow through what I did. And even though there was no words, it was instrumental, that God's Holy Spirit could flow. And he said, I would do this stuff. And back in those old days, I'd be in my studio and these guys would get on the phone. I'd put the phone receiver up to the speaker in my studio. And the guys at Nat Geo would be listening to the music. And he said, I'd get off the phone and they'd all be crying. They'd be so deeply touched by this music. We don't know what it is about this music touching us. So he goes, that's how he started in doing music for film. So Charlie's lives in Colorado here. He's sort of a brother from another mother. From our standpoint, we're close. Yeah. And we love working together. So it's been fun to work on this project. We continue to distribute shows as well. We're very much like a label where we work with other producers.
Uh-huh. And that's real films, right?
Yeah,
real.
So Exploration Films is the distribution part. So if you go to explorationfilms.com, you'll see a bunch of different films.
Yeah.
And then Real Productions is sort of the mothership, and that's our production company for the stuff we do.
For you. Yeah.
So that's the way
and that's
it works.
Who did then, the Ark of the Covenant thing.
That's right. That's right.
And First Mount
Love,
Sinai
and
thing.
Mount Sinai and Incredible Creatures. Yeah. And
that, Incredible Creatures. I'm really glad to see you do the Master Designer because Incredible Creatures was like a breakthrough thing.
I met this guy who was giving these little talks in universities around the country, secular universities, and he would describe these animal systems that were very complex. And so when I met him, he'd been doing this for a long time, and I said, let's do a film about this. Ended up doing 3 DVDs. I mean, literally out of the trunk of our car, we sold 1.2 million of them. It was ridiculous.
Because they're amazing.
Because people, again, connected with nature, loved this whole story. Yeah. And that led to doing a deal with Netflix, and 400,000 people rated them, which is ridiculous when you think about it.
Actually rated them.
Rated them, you know. So in a way, you know, Master Designer is kind of a continuation of that big idea.
Yes.
A little bit different. Our host for the Old Incredible Creatures series was killed in Haiti during that big earthquake. He was serving the poor, working with Compassion International, working on a project for them. So after we got over the shock of the loss of David and our scientists who had some health issues, we began to think about how are we going to continue to tell this story, but in a different storytelling model. And then we came up with the Master Designer.
Well, that's a beautiful thing.
So it's a newer model. I think it's fresher. And
well, I'm very excited about continuation of all that God is doing and being just in the wings watching it happen.
I love it. You keep singing and I'll keep doing films.
What else can we do?
Seriously.
God bless you, man.
Love you,
Jerry.
Keep
up the good work.
Love you, friend.
Love you, too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All the music you hear me sing on this program, Terry Clark and Friends, is available at our website, catalystpeople.com, CATALYST, like in chemistry, people.com. Please come and visit us soon.